Welcome to Conker's Corner. This is Peter Higgins here. Today I have the privilege of speaking with Andy Woolmer of New Change FX. Andy, good morning to you, sir.
Morning, Peter. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Now, I appreciate you taking this time. I know there's lots going on in the FX world.
Not at all.
And we're going to do this Conker's Corner, essentially going to cover your background, and then we're going to talk primarily about FX. You okay with that?
Absolutely. Sounds good.
Okie dokie. Now, Andy, I wanted to touch firstly on your background. We can go as far back as where you did your degree and what you've been doing for the past, couple of decades. I know you're still a young man.
I was very privileged to grow up in Gloucestershire and came to London in 1988 to do a degree in French and German. And on leaving King's College, went into the foreign exchange markets and joined Kleinwort Benson, as it was it was probably 1992, I suppose that would have been. Okay. And that's where my life in FX began.
Okie dokie. Now, you said you studied French and German at King's College. What was the connection and the leap from that to foreign exchange? Was it a case of language skills and you did journeys between that?
Funnily enough, absolutely. Although okay. I have to say, and Kleinwort Benson was bought by Dresdner Bank in whenever that was after the Bearings episode. Yeah. And, funnily enough, the foreign exchange world seems to not value any form of foreign language skills. So, despite having had those skills, I think at Dresdner Bank, the official language of the bank at the time was, in fact, English. So, you'd have a meeting of 15 Germans and me able to speak German.
Yeah.
And, they'd do the whole thing in English. But,
amazing.
There you are.
Okay. So, we're looking back at 92 now. You start at Kleinwort Benson. Yeah. What was your first role there? Because you're obviously fully newly qualified.
Well, I think my main role was to go and get sandwiches and coffee for everybody else, and spot desk assistant, and just fetching and carrying and making sure everything worked. But you start to pick up the elements of trading and those kind of things, and they did a very good rotation scheme in those days, so you get to spend a bit of time on various desks in the treasury area, so that it was very, very interesting. And of course, in those days, non-electronic.
Yes, of course.
So it was direct relationships with people and telephones and quite a bit of shouting, I seem to remember as well. quite a tactile and quite a human business.
Yeah, because back in them days, it was a case of the youngsters were shown the ropes and taken around, and had to go off in meetings and stand in the background and just listen and be a voyeur almost as well, didn't you?
Well, I don't want to romanticise it, because they were very, very long days, and it would generally start at 6:30 and you work solidly until 5:00, and then there would be some expectation that you'd go to the pub and see your counterparts in the market
a little bit,
but it was good fun. Sort of thing you can do when you're young, I guess.
Yes, most definitely. Now, with regards to investing or taking any sort of place in the investment world regarding a portfolio or making a first stock purchase, do you remember when you first did that?
Yeah, I think it was probably around the time that, obviously I didn't have any money before that job. So that was the first time we did it. And it's really, for me, it's only ever been funnily enough, a very conservative journey.
Yeah. Okay.
And something that has been, very much driven by, pension allocations and those sorts of things, rather than sort of out and out speculation.
Okie dokie. So, with regards to your first foray then, back in the 90s, do you remember purchasing a particular stock or a particular fund to start your pension allocation?
Yeah, I think it was sort of, I can't quite remember who it was, but obviously my wife's very involved in the investment trust world, and it's been, generally speaking, a UK-focused investment trust. I mean, I think that, with a focus on income I can't remember exactly what it
it's
was.
Okay.
But, I think my sort of more general view, I mean, before we started this business, my business partner and I spent 8 years at SEB, the Swedish bank, allocating capital to hedge funds. And, you know, I think in my personal investment life, I suppose that I have exactly the, you know, a very conservative view and a, you know, a desire to identify solid sources of income for, in exchange for reasonably low risk or suitable levels of risk. And I think the problem, you know, certainly in the hedge fund world, you know, all that glitters is not gold, and anything that looks like an unusual return is probably unusual for bad reasons.
For bad reasons, yeah.
Yeah. So, the focus has been very much on making sure that, you know, obviously the hardest thing in the world is to acquire the capital. And, you know, once you've sweated to acquire the capital, you don't want to, you know, lose it.
And no. You want to grow it steadily.
Well, right, yeah.
So at the moment then, regarding your pensions and your other portfolios, would you say that that's primarily in funds rather than, you know, individual stocks?
Oh, absolutely, yes, yes. I don't do any individual stocks at all.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, there's lots of asset managers with very good expertise. And you know, that's really what I like to buy. I mean, I think there's a fee for that, obviously. There's costs, and there's quite a lot of focus on costs.
Yeah.
But you know, I try to make sure that, you know, we're the investments are conservative in nature, income generative, you know, with a strong capital preservation theme.
Okie dokie. So, given that 100% of them are in funds of your portfolio, and you're more or less UK focused, would you say that the majority of that is UK focused, or do you diversify enough to have a few in emerging and a few even FX related sort of funds?
Yes, I think at the moment there's nothing. I mean, obviously, any fund that's internationally invested has a foreign exchange
FX edge,
component.
Yeah.
Absolutely, but you know, there is some emerging market stuff in there, and I would say that's about as risky as that gets.
Okay.
But you know, it's really just a question of making sure that we get nice steady income off these things.
Okie dokie. So with regards to the funds that you've invested in, the long-term sort of view of planning ahead for rainy days and time to chill out after the children have gone off to university.
I'm not sure they're that clever.
I'm sure they are. What has been your greatest lesson since you started investing long-term regarding your funds, etc.?
I think the point is that, I mean, the most significant lesson is that, you know, that you can buy expertise. You know, it's not hard. You know, you can go to, there's sources of information. I mean, I obviously always use the AIC's website, but you know, the point of all of these things is that, you know, it's very, very hard to make money. Nobody gives money away. And I think that the big lesson has been that, you know, if you can find something that is going to give you a reasonable return, that is a better bet than, you know, the thing that, you know, the single stock that suddenly invented a cure for something, or a, you know, those kind of things, which are incredibly speculative. And I think that, you know, the stuff that's worked well for us over time has been very much more conservative in its I mean, you know, things like BH Macro have been very strong performers in a more hedge fundy way. But you know, these are companies making you know, reasonable bets.
Okay. So with regards to that, and now you've been investing for a long time since 93, 94, when you started earning a little bit of money, and you've moved on and you've set your own company up. What's been your wisest investment today, Andy?
Well, probably my wisest investment was marrying somebody very sensible.
oh, she'll be very pleased with that when she hears that one.
But I think I'm not going to single anything out particularly. But I mean, it's you know, the question for us now is whether the investment of time and effort in our own company is, you know, hopefully it ends up being the wisest investment.
Of course, yeah. Okay, so. Given the many lessons that you've learned since you started investing, which one would you most like to share with our audience and listeners?
Well, I think the one of my boring and conservative lesson
Right.
is I'm sorry to
Slow
be
and steady
boring.
wins the race.
I'm sorry to be boring and
No, it's
conservative and
okay.
say it
It's
again and
okay.
again, Peter. But
That's.
the idea that you're going to get something is going to make you millions and millions of pounds just overnight. I mean, everybody. The problem I suspect is that a lot of people talk in terms of, if you think about Peter Thiel, who put $5 million into Facebook and made a billion,
Yeah.
those kind of stories are fantastic,
Yeah.
but they're not available. They are to coin a phrase, black swans. I mean, it's
Yeah. Rare.
yeah, and you can't. I mean, obviously, the whole point about a black swan is you can't forecast a black swan.
Yeah.
So I think that the real lesson is that good performing, well performing managers are. You can identify them. You can, if you can identify good managers, identify people who, for the risk, and by risk I sort of mean volatility. So, a statistical measure of risk as opposed to, ooh, some sort of arbitrary kind of view of it. Yeah, I think you can identify, very good managers who are able to provide very healthy returns over time. And the biggest lesson is that you might want the moon on a stick, but
Very rarely happens, yeah.
and if somebody promises it to you, treat it with extreme skepticism
Absolutely.
and diversify. I think that that's the other lesson, is to
Yeah.
try to hold something in sensible areas and in sensible sectors. It's not hard to see that, maybe, for example, people who are doing stuff in the interesting IT sectors and things like that are kind of perhaps ones for the future.
Yeah.
But house builders and things like that, it's never going to be, those sort of areas aren't ever going to go out of fashion, really.
Agreed, agreed. Now, Andy, I wanted to touch on your recent win, the FX Week TSA Provider of the Year award,
TCA,
which
TCA,
TCA, sorry, TCA.
transaction cost analysis.
Yeah, best transaction cost analysis provider, second year running. Congratulations on that. That's where I first noted your name and spoke with Annabelle. Now, congratulations on that. I wanted you to touch on what that actually means for those outside of the FX industry. Which you touched on it earlier about the importance of cost, and I know that lots of people now are getting very, very angry about charges that fund managers are putting in place and taking off the table regarding cost. And as you touched on earlier, that there's not a lot of there's not enough adherence taken to the cost of the international funds, etc.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that our experience. So, I mean, just to give you a little background, Toby and I set up New Change, what would be 4 years ago,
Yeah.
and what we recognised when we were running our own funds was that it's very hard to understand foreign exchange costs. I think that people, in the main, expect that their foreign exchange costs are well managed. But what we found in running our own funds is that they can end up being very, very high. I mean, I think, the understanding of most investment businesses is that it's done on a brokerage basis. So, if I want to buy a stock from you, a broker will facilitate that, and it'll go through an exchange, and everything will be very transparent and very clear. It's like if you're buying a house, the estate agent facilitates that purchase, but and gets paid a commission, but isn't, financially, well, shouldn't be financially incentivized either way.
Yeah.
Just they are there to fulfill your transaction. The problem with foreign exchange is that it's like buying a house, but with nobody in the middle, right? So,
Yeah.
what's good for me is bad for you. The higher the cost of the house, the worse for me. The higher the cost of the house, the better for you. It's this adversarial relationship that exists in foreign exchange. So, most of an investment manager's relationships with the market are seen through the lens of some form of agency. except for foreign exchange, where,
Right, okay.
you know, the relationship is absolutely adversarial. So the asset manager needs to be on top of the cost. So we found when we were asset managers that it was very, very, despite being foreign exchange professionals, it was very, very hard to manage that. And what we wanted to do was find a way of correcting the information asymmetry between the asset manager and the bank.
Okay.
So very simply, I mean, if you've there was a piece of research out by Greenwich in the last week or so. It was published on Reuters, and they were talking about the fact that 87% of asset managers have globally, of the ones they surveyed, I think about 600, 87% don't actually have any form of transaction cost analysis, and of the small percentage that do have some form of transaction cost analysis, much of that analysis simply involves saying, oh, we asked three banks and we traded on the best price, as if there wasn't an adversarial relationship, and then just asking three banks who, you know, it's in their interest to make the price as worse as bad as they possibly can would make a fair price. So, you know, our goal was just to give the asset managers, or is to give the asset managers, a very simple piece of information, which is the same piece of information that the bank has at the point of transacting. So, you know, once you have that information, you can understand how much you're paying.
And, of course,
then things change.
And limit that, and then less charges means better returns for the long term. Yeah.
Yeah, we think you probably, you know, I mean, I think the one thing that's quite shocking to us is that you know, managers need to have a good understanding of how much foreign exchange they do. And obviously, you know, I'm not talking about foreign exchange speculation here at all. I mean, these are foreign exchange transactions that are simply required by the fund as a result of underlying business activity. So if you acquire a stock or a bond that is not denominated in the base currency of the fund, i.e. you're making an international investment, then you have a foreign exchange transaction to do. And quite often those transactions are done by the custodian or by the back office, and there's very little control. But I mean, you know, quite reasonably, I mean, you shouldn't need to pay expensive foreign exchange dealers to do those deals. But without any kind of measure or control in that process, you can't know what you're paying. So what we do, I mean, just to take you back a step and consider how a foreign exchange price is made, a bank will, before they quote you, will assess the mid price of their own liquidity. So what we do is we assess the mid price of the foreign exchange markets completely, you know, across the board, 20 times a second. And we then make sure that for every millisecond of the day, essentially, we can give you a reference price. And we don't make those prices available to trade, and therefore they're not affected directly by the activity of the market. So, you know, once you've got that, you understand, right, okay, well, this bank's doing really, really well for me, and this bank's not doing so well. Why don't I just phone that bank and just say, look, I'd like some better pricing here. And that's what people do. And we find, you know, asset managers, I think our average across, in 4 years, we've done quite a bit of this now. The average asset manager, when they begin working with us, is paying $450 a million to execute the foreign exchange trades. And after they've reviewed their costs and gone back to their suppliers, they reduce that to around $230 a million. And actually the very best, I think, has got his costs down to about $70 a million.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah, but I mean, that's investors' money.
Yes, it is.
And you know, I know there's lots of chat about charges and all these things, but actually, if you don't know what you're paying for something, it doesn't even figure as a charge. You know, these are costs that, you know, I mean, the very best asset managers understand in dollars a million what they're paying for their foreign exchange. They understand in detail what volumes they do, and they understand in detail what they pay for those volumes and what's reasonable. Because obviously, you know, they can't do it for nothing. I mean, there has to be a charge. So that's the goal.
And do you think some of this is about the fact that a lot of fund managers think or assume that their expertise in actually making the returns and in making the right investments particular stocks globally, that's going to far exceed the point of percent that they lose on the FX.
You know, I think that the expertise that asset managers have is, you know, they want to focus and you know, be directly applicable to what they're doing in the markets that they're in. They shouldn't have to worry about their foreign exchange. The way this should work is that the asset management company should have, you know, the control. There should be, maybe it's the COO or the compliance department or somebody like that, have responsibility to make sure that they're minimizing the cost. That's right. And I think that, you know, I mean, what difference does it make? Well, I don't know. If you look at the MSCI World last year, it was down 32 basis points. My guess is that if you optimize the foreign exchange costs out of that index, you didn't use silly things, you know, you did something better than their benchmark, then, you know, you could have easily made that actually into a positive. So, you know, it does have a performance impact, yes. And, you know, we see over time that the, you know, guys who are the very best, they are adding, you know, 10% to their returns, not 10% return. They are adding 10% to their returns. Simply by being very, very efficient in every area. I'm reminded of Dave Brailsford, the Sir Dave Brailsford, after all, you know, the cycling guru, because he said, you know, it's not about big things; it's about all the small things. It's about marginal 1% here, 1% there. That all adds up, and I think that I would have thought investors want to know that they select the asset managers who have the best policies across the board. And where you've got these frictional costs, you know, brokerage in general, you know, all of the trading flow, that people are on top of it. And, you know, if you think about, what did I say, 83% or 87. It might have been 83. I could have had that wrong.
Okay.
But whatever, a large percentage of asset managers don't use TCA. If you then think that the average bank makes about 20% of its bottom line out of foreign exchange, you kind of get some sense of the what we're trying to correct.
Yes.
And, you know, our goal here, Peter, is really, you know, we're not critical, okay? We're not saying that somebody is doing something wrong. What we're saying is it isn't hard to have the information. It's not expensive. We don't charge a great deal. It's very easy. We deliver everything via Excel, so you don't need complicated computer systems or anything like that. Everything is just done on Excel. We believe very strongly in data security, so we make sure that people don't send their information outside of their organizations. And we give people a benchmark, which is the same benchmark that their bank is using at the point of trading. And that becomes, you know, and you know, it's all about milliseconds and all that stuff.
And it's you're providing a value-added service, basically. You know.
We think absolutely. I mean, funnily enough, actually, the what we find with our clients is that most clients, I mean, you know, institutions do a great deal of foreign exchange.
Yeah.
Every month, an institution will have a keying error on a trade. You know, one or two will go through with a fat finger error, as we call it. So somebody, you know, it inverted two digits, or, you know, something went a little wrong in the process. Now, those transactions, if you are able to check at the end of every day or as you're doing the trades, if there is an excessive cost, you spot that immediately. So most people save our fee every quarter simply by weeding out all of these processing errors. So quite aside from the savings that might be made overall by simply being a little sharper, and actually, you know, frankly, to my mind, this is now a marketing issue for asset managers almost rather than anything else. You know, who wants to, you want to be able to say to your investors, look, we do everything really well. We're a very high quality company. I think that, you know, that the things like making sure you have transaction cost analysis, and obviously making sure that transaction cost analysis isn't just derived directly from your trading platform, because of course there's been a lot of talk about transaction cost analysis on brokerage in America. So I think it's now used by 100% of asset managers in the States.
That's a good model then.
But the problem is that a lot of that's sold as a way of brokers kind of saying, hey, my platform's great, you should use this. You know, our view is that transaction cost analysis needs to be independent of the entire transaction chain. So, you know, you capture the cost of doing business completely. You don't obfuscate bits of it in the fact that you're getting TCA from a platform. You know, if you use a platform to trade on and then use a platform to measure, then the measurement hides the latency, market impact, whatever that comes from the platform.
And then inherent in that is the conflicts of interest, as you've touched on already, which has led to lots of other scandals over the past 10 years.
We seem to be the foreign exchange market seems to be producing scandals at a fairly high rate at the moment, and obviously, there's an issue at the moment with HSBC traders being arrested in the States, and I think there's an awful lot of conflict in that particular case. But you know, you can see that the fines that have been levied on the banks, I mean, they're the biggest fine. I mean, I think the only fines bigger, you'd have to blow up an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico to get fined more than the banks have been fined for foreign exchange. But somehow, you know, investors aren't kind of exercised by this. You know, it seems odd to me. You know, it's a massively profitable business for a number of banks, but investors are not saying, hey, does that not apply to me? You know, it's coming out of your pocket. So you know, that I guess is changing, I hope.
Well, I hope so, because you know, there's been a fair few scandals. You've had Tom Hayes, you've got the Barclays two now, that's going on. I can't pronounce the chap's name. Is it Contogulus and Reich of Barclays? Have recently been arrested and going through stuff. So there's going to be more. And I think part of it is the fact that certain establishments are thinking, you know what, this has been going on, we need to put a stop to it. And also, here's an opportunity for us to pull some money out of this bank or that bank and put it back into our treasury. You know, there's lots of money being pulled out of the banks, you know, to billions of pounds have been pulled out of various banks over the last umpteen years and fines. And we've not seen the benefit of that money to then regulate and impose statutes or situations whereby it gets eradicated, because everyone says it's only going to happen again. So what's the money actually being used for that's been taken away on fines?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't George Osborne going to give it to somebody to? I can't remember. There was some sort of tax benefit, wasn't there, for that came directly from fire? I can't remember. But it seems that the opportunity for banks to develop very clean models for these things is unparalleled. You know, clients don't seem to be very happy, but you know, we don't see banks really willing to walk away from the old business models as of yet. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that, you know, now, I mean, as we can see from the HSBC case and Tom Hayes, you know, people are, you know, people's liberty is at risk if they are not telling the client precisely what happens. Now, the problem in foreign exchange, as I said earlier, is that relationships are adversarial. You know, we have a principal-to-principal market, and you know, maybe we are going to move to an agency market, but you know, I think customers need to understand that the relationship isn't straightforward, and that over time things need to change. But you know, I mean, what I really see is that the opportunity for, you know, banks is unparalleled in the area of just saying, right, okay, well, we're going to change the model, we're going to do it this way rather than that way, and offer a different service. So, you know, and I think people are starting to start what are called agency desks and try to act in the foreign exchange markets in the same way that they act in, say, the equity markets, where you know, the conflicts, well, I mean, it's not to say that the equity markets aren't without their issues, but you know, maybe they're slightly different issues. I mean, certainly, you know, this benchmarking issue in foreign exchange is pretty clearly creates conflicts of interest, which now you know, aren't of any benefit to banks, despite the fact that they can make money from them.
Okay, so with the company that you've set up now at New Age, and the progress that you've made over the last 4 years, do you see this this need for TCA leading to a UK body, or is it something that you're striving for, Andy?
New change.
Change.
It's No, I mean, we think that the regulatory structures are good enough. The people who are involved, what I would say is, by and large, certainly amongst the asset managers we deal with and the regulatory bodies that we deal with, there is an increasing understanding of the need for transaction cost analysis, an increasing understanding of why assessing costs in foreign exchange should be done slightly differently than in other markets. I mean, it's simply not the same as an equity market, as we said. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's what's called, quite aside from the adversarial relationship, it's a quote-driven market.
Yeah.
And you know, it doesn't work the same way as equities. There is no central market. So you know, we think that things are changing the right way.
Okay.
People take it seriously now. I mean, I think, you know, 3 years ago when we started, 4 years ago when we started, people were kind of, yeah, well, no, I'm sure it, A, doesn't impact me, B, it's not worth worrying about, C, I can't be bothered, D, you know, go away.
Yeah. As with all new things, until it becomes the norm, it's usually the case, yeah.
Well, the thing is, I think that you know, if you're in a position of responsibility in an asset management company, you need to think about what these kind of, you know, does it impact you? Well, you're doing foreign exchange, so you've got...
take responsibility for it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't just ignore it. You can't just sort of say, well, you know, that doesn't apply to me. Well, you know, if you're doing it, it does.
It does.
You know?
Well, I think what you've introduced to me there, Andy, is a very, very important new question to add to my questions when I interview future, past and current fund managers. So I'll be adding that question in regarding transaction costs, most definitely. Now, yeah. Andy, I've got a couple more questions for you, to cover the landscape of things. If there's one thing you could change, and I know we've touched on the FX landscape, if there's one thing you could change about your industry right now that you couldn't do back in 1992, what would that be? Other than obviously the stuff that we've covered. We've covered that bit, yeah.
What I'd change? I don't know. I think I would, you know, I mean, obviously we campaign for transparency. And I mean, you know, I would like everyone to understand all of their costs and all of the returns that they're getting in exchange for those costs. And I think that, you know, that's the direction of travel. But I think that, you know, good asset managers would be able to differentiate themselves much more effectively in that kind of environment. And it seems to me that there's quite a lot of low quality products out there that hides behind the fact that they can look sort of, you know, everyone looks roughly the same.
Okay.
But there's, you know, there are top quality guys out there, and guys and girls, and you know, it's not an industry that's it should be an industry in which talent and edge is rewarded. And I find that, you know, all of this fluff stuck around the issue, you know, costs and all these things, that should all just be brutally, you know, set out.
Yeah.
Every single cost that's incurred, cost of your back office, cost of staff, cost of trading, your market impact cost inherent in the ways that things are traded, just so that people can understand, okay, this guy is a little bit more efficient than that group.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can make a bit more of an informed decision. And I think that clarity and transparency is what we're after.
Excellent. I love that reply. Thank you. Now, you've been in the industry from, you know, from boy to man, as they say, 92, 93, 94, to present day. And you've seen it, all different things come and go. What would you, in your very, very personal view, be of the best kept secret to FX trading and markets, etc.?
Well, best kept secret in foreign exchange is avoid doing it at all costs. I mean, we haven't even touched on the idea of trading speculatively. But I would, my personal recommendation would be that is not a form of investment. You know, it amazes me that these businesses, you know, that encourage individuals to trade in foreign exchange exist. I mean, we've never in 20 years, I've never seen a trader, you know, we've handled some fairly big ones over that time, really do well long term out of foreign exchange. So, you know, it's a way of, you know, brokers make a lot of money from private individuals. I mean, they generally never hedge their trades. I mean, it's, you know, that sort of tells you everything you need to know. Avoid speculation and manage costs. I think that you can improve your returns very simply by doing those two things. You know,
we can touch on the private ones, PIs that have got involved in foreign currency trading, and also large entities. We had a couple of occasions not so long ago when the Swiss unpegged and the whole world went down like the Titanic. You know, and invariably there's going to be a couple of more occasions like that, because lots of people, lots of other currencies are still pegged in a certain way, or you know, yeah, or looking to race to the bottom, you know, to devalue their currency, because that's the race that's going on now. But not everyone can have the lowest currency. So how does that pan out?
Yeah, it's a relative value trade, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, what goes down, one goes down, one goes up. You know, yeah, it absolutely. The SNB action was frankly ridiculous and irresponsible of the SNB. I don't think that they should, you know, it's not really sensible that a central bank says one week, yeah, we're keeping this peg, and then, you know, pulls the thing out the following week. It's caused enormous. Yeah.
I think it was a Sunday evening as well, so everybody woke up and went,
Monday
morning.
No. I
mean, Sunday evening, Monday morning, yeah.
9 o'clock on a Monday morning in London, and it was
staggering.
It was astonishing, yeah. I mean, absolutely ridiculous that they behaved that way. But I mean, I don't think that they maybe understood exactly what they were doing. Who knows? But the impact has been significant. I think there's a lot of people who now understand what their contracts with their brokers mean. Yeah. Foreign exchange, you know, it's changed the landscape for institutions, because it's altered the way that banks supply prime brokerage. A number of banks have in fact pulled out of prime brokerage after that. So
lots of brokerages went under that after that month or so as well. Yeah.
I mean, it was you know, a totally irresponsible piece of central bank behavior. But you know, I think hopefully it does highlight that, you know, these aren't, you know, foreign exchange markets can move violently. I mean, you know, what was that? I was probably about 60% down at one stage.
One stage, yeah.
Yeah. You know, on a levered basis, that can be extraordinarily painful. So,
indeed.
I mean, your point about other pegs going, I suppose, you know, there's a lot of talk about Saudi and I mean, closer to home, Denmark, you know, things like that. But, you know, essentially, I think that the key advice is that, you know, foreign exchange speculation isn't investing.
Exactly.
There's some sort of definitional issues around whether it's an asset class at all. You know, the people we see who make money out of foreign exchange and do very well at it are supplying liquidity to the markets. And, you know, if you're acting as a market maker, you're the other side of the
trade.
Yeah, that's right. And you've got sort of, you know, we see a great deal of expertise moving out of banks into independent market makers now. And I think some of the biggest market makers in the world will be non-banks, or are already non-banks, I should say. And that trend will continue. And I think, you know, we've seen that very clearly in equities. But I think that will continue, you know, in foreign exchange, and technology will become more and more relevant. And those are the big shifts.
Yeah, I wanted to touch a tiny little bit on the technology aspect, because there's lots of talk now and companies and startups in relation to Bitcoin, blockchain. And I was wondering if you thought that given whether it be 6 months or 2 years, what impact that would have on foreign exchange. And I know that ICAP are getting involved, and lots of banks are getting involved in the blockchain technology side of things.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you know, this goes to my point about the model changing.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
evolving,
I think,
all the time.
Yeah, and of course, banks have the pockets that are deep enough to you know, back a few losers, and before they find the, you know, kiss a few frogs, I would say, before they find the winner. But I mean, it's, you know, I think the blockchain, you know, I mean, technology is obviously the correct path in anything, really. But you know, it's just as applicable in foreign exchange as anything else. And I think that the blockchain Well, not just blockchain. I mean, there's lots and lots and lots of other technologies that are relevant. And I think that the, you know, if you think about what a bank is nowadays, essentially it's a collection of legal agreements and people. And, you know, I think that, you know, that becomes very interesting from a technology perspective, you know, because how many people do you need? And, you know, how does this structure really work more efficiently? I think we'll see some significant changes into in the ways that banks operate in the future. But, you know, that's some way off, I think. Actually, I think asset management wise, it's probably more interesting because, of course, you know, what asset managers might be able to move towards is a more efficient custody environment where, you know, as I say, the frictional costs of the asset management process, which come from you know, holding assets and all the rest of it, which had really nothing to do with the asset manager directly, could be eliminated. So, you know, it could be, you know, great for everybody, really.
Okay. Now, Andy, I've covered all my questions bar one. I'm a big fan of my investing books, my you know, list, you know, reading of this guru and that guru and strategies and styles. And I just wondered if you could share with us your favorite books or what it is that you you know, authors that you always go to when you're thinking of taking some time out and reading a book whilst you're on holiday.
I've just finished Marlon James's Brief History of Seven Killings, which, if you're interested in the extraordinarily violent history of Jamaica, then it might be one for the beach. But by and large, you know, any form of fiction is of interest to me.
Right. So you spend your 90% of your week in the factual world of FX, and you just want to just escape into fiction.
Yeah, I'm not. Yes. I mean, you know,
Understandable. It's understandable.
I think I'm reading William Maxwell at the moment. So, yeah, sometimes incredibly depressing and fiction as a counterpoint to the incredibly depressing and miserable markets occasionally. Yeah. But there we are.
We need a juxtapose there. Definitely.
Yeah, maybe.
All right, Andy, I've covered all my questions. I didn't know if there's anything else you wanted to share or to cover or you think I've missed that we could talk about
Not at all.
Okie dokie. Well, and Andy, I wanted to leave you with this message. I want to thank you ever so much for coming on and talking about New Change and what you've done with that. Congratulations winning the award 2 years running. I want to come back at some point in the future, if I may, to speak with you about some other things in relation to FX when we take Conquest Corner a bit further forward. I'm planning to speak to quite a lot of fund managers going forward. Mm. So I'm going to be introducing your question about transactional cost. And I'll be quoting said, Andy Woolmer said, you guys need to start doing this. So, no, it's been an absolute pleasure, Andy. Thank your good wife again for introducing us.
Indeed.
And I will be putting out your podcast in a couple of weeks' time, and I'll keep you posted.
Lovely. Thank you, Peter.
All right. Have a great day and enjoy your weekend, Andy. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.